Well, in 1946, one of our popular writers in Minneapolis telling us...
Words which are grouped together. Now, just to cut this very short, we found this also in so-called figured poems, when poems were written in certain figures, I read one modern one by William Thomas, that was this shape, a diamond shape. You have all the most fantastic ones with and without words. The most fantastic one, by the way, I've ever seen in this particular was one by Morgenstern, a funny German author, who wrote one which is called The Evening Prayer of the Fish. Now, guess who gave me that idea? and it is shaped like a fish. The poem is shaped like a fish, only it doesn't have words. You know, it is written or made out of symbols for long and short. Have you ever seen that? This long is just a long line, a dash, and short is a little, what would you call that?
A breathing.
Yeah, a breathing. Okay, that thing. And so it's just when the fish come up to the surface, if they ever do that, you know, they just, or what she does with the bubble gum, so it's a drip. Sometimes long, sometimes short, you know. And this poem is just shaped like a fish, you know. You can do anything with symbols for long and short in metric. You know? This people fool around with. And then, as we said, the most important thing, however, was to find relationships similarly to this square here. Now, not only with individual words, but especially with also with meanings and then with metaphors. You know, you do not necessarily coordinate or the two things you compare. It's as you say, let's say your lips are red like a rose. This makes sense. The lips are red, the rose is red, and you get a little more by comparing those two or putting them into a certain kind of relationship. You can also, but you can also have something that is entirely opposite, as we had yesterday in a modern poem, for instance, when a guy said black milk, you know, which is ridiculous. There is no black milk, you know, in the poem. But this is being done, of course, what he means. Black stands for death, milk stands for nourishment, and in this poem, the people, the Jews in the concentration camp in this particular case, were forced to drink death as their only nourishment day after day till they were killed. You see, this is one means of expressing it. By basically, again, to repeat this, by putting things, let's say, together that ordinarily do not belong together. And so the artist, the mannerist artist, looks for these hidden, unknown relationships, puts together all sorts of things that actually should not belong together ordinarily. And thus gets a certain effect, something strange. And sometimes it is filled with meaning, sometimes it's just playing, you know, when there's nothing. In connection with this, another point is, we said maybe at the root of this kind of art, is the impossibility to give a definite answer. So when you talk about, let me again refer to this poem that we read yesterday afternoon. When you are confronted with such a tremendous terror and horror as took place in the concentration camp, now you cannot write this down in smooth verse form, excellent rhyme schemes, you know, and what have you. This would contradict the meaning. You cannot really express what you want to say. So the opposite is what Steve also already found with Michelangelo. When you want to express something horrible, you cannot express it smoothly or elegantly. No, that would not fit the purpose. Therefore, this school of artists tries to destroy this form intentionally in order to be adequate to what they want to say. But it is a strange way. And then you cannot reach a decision. You cannot solve anything. You cannot harmonize, or you do not want to center. And so you leave it open. You know, it's neither fish nor flesh, as we saw. It is neither man nor woman. The best example is Mona Lisa. Well, we mentioned this last time, I think. Where you just a few brush strokes, an American artist has done that, and this woman is a man. You don't have to change much. You don't know, is she smiling also, or is she crying? You know, this being in between, unable to reach a decision, to reach a conclusion, to do something. This is what they do intentionally, again, because no fixed answer can be given. Any kind of answer that can be given is necessarily a bad answer. Now, we found these things. I read a few examples for these funny relationships, these funny hidden meanings that were found in many poems. And as I said, this was first discovered in the period shortly after the Italian Renaissance movement in art primarily, and then people looked around and found it in the same period also in literature. Now the next step was to look around and say, was that really the only time when this kind of mannerist literature was written? Was it only written shortly after the Italian Renaissance, this is in the 16th century primarily, or were there other periods in which a similar kind of literature and similar kind of art was created? And of course, if you look hard, you find it. And this is something we want to look at. Today, I said, we just want to see how we can look at this phenomenon of mannerism historically. And people looked, as we said, and looked and looked and really found the first mannerist period, very, very early, already in the 5th century BC. When the Greeks got in contact with people in their colonies, primarily in the Near East, in the area which is nowadays Turkey, they got acquainted with a different kind of style, which we know of via Cicero. Is that how you pronounce him? I never know how Greek and Latin pronounce American as well, I just have to make sure. Okay. They found that in Cicero, when he gave, Cicero gives some advice on what good rhetoric, good a piece of prose or literature should be like, and then he says, not like those other guys, right? And this is how we get it. And this is what he primarily found, as we might say nowadays, in the colonies, you know, and an abundance of metaphors he found, so that the meaning is almost hidden, which is very, very interesting. A lot of puns, an abundance of rhetorical questions, and all sorts of tricks similar to what you have on the board. The main representative for those people were Empedocles, whom we do not really have much, and the philosopher Heraclitus, is that right?
Yeah.
Pronunciation Heraclitus in...
Heraclitus.
I don't know.
I've heard him both ways.
Okay, fine. As main examples for this kind of writing. What they clashed with at that time was the theory of the imitation of nature, or mimesis as it was called. In other words, you did not imitate or not take off from something that was well known, that we simplified very much, but your reference point was your own imagination, your own fantasy, and not what you found in nature. Right? And therefore you could come up with the most fantastic things. You could find all sorts of relationships and meanings that you would never find, let's say, in a realistic context. This then got a little bit mixed up with Plato's idea that every poet has to have a certain kind of madness, which would indicate that he is a genius. So the mannerist took this and said, marvelous, but that's exactly what we need. So we find this, although we do not have that many testimonies of it, but we already find it in the 5th century BC, very early, a definite kind of mannerism. Mostly we can gather this from the writings of Cicero. Now, the second time we find it, again a similar thing, after a highly developed period of art, a classical period, you find something else, you find sort of the reversal of it. And this second time it took place was shortly after the highlight of the medieval period, primarily 15th and 14th centuries, and then a little bit going down to the 16th and that much. And this is primarily in Germany and a little bit also in England, although this is kind of strange. I don't know whether you're familiar with the fact that there was a tremendous amount of excellent literature in Germany in the 12th and 13th centuries, probably one of the greatest highlights of German literature ever at that time, although it is Middle High German, and so maybe you're not quite familiar with it, but maybe you know these stories of Tristan and Isolde, or maybe you're all familiar with the King Arthur and the Round Table, right? All these stories around it, you know, all the knights have certain adventures, not Camelot type, but very serious, how to live in the world, how to search for God, and so on. And each knight on King Arthur's Round Table stands for one way of doing that. So for heaven's sake, don't think of the musical. It's a very serious thing. And shortly after this this very structured period, this harmonious search for God and how to live in the world, when this was over, you find that all of a sudden crudeness gets in. We might almost call it pornography that gets in. It's nothing new. We've all been there before. The poems get frightfully filthy all of a sudden. You know, they also had sex in the 13th century. He needed that. The structures of the high epics which were written at the time, you know, this high elevated style was destroyed, and you ended up with a very shallow, entertaining kind of prose. This also took place in the same period after this high scholastic period of thinking was over. Maybe just as a throw the name Thomas Aquinas at you. In the wake of Thomas Aquinas, you find certain plays with words almost similar to what you have on the board, primarily a kind of thinking that was no longer, let's say, adequate to what you want to say. Intentional false conclusion queries. Let me give you a few examples of what they thought was really marvelous. Strictly logical syllogisms which were changed. For instance, man has reason. First statement. A child does not have a reason. That's the second statement. The third statement, a child is not human or not a man. Or a better one, what you didn't lose, you still must have. Is that okay? Understand? What you did not lose, you still must have, right? You did not lose any horns, is the second one. Third one, you must have horns. I mean, you can probably detect the mistake, where they took off and made that mistake, you know. But this was also considered to be a kind of truth, or even nicer. You cannot be what I am. What? Is that okay? You cannot be what I am. I'm different from you. Okay. I am a man. Statement number two. You are not a man. Or, or you are not human. Then it's even nicer. Okay. This kind of thinking helps also the creation of that kind of art. Although I must say there was not that much art created after this decay of the high medieval classical period. Then, number three, the third period, we move into the period that from which actually we started out with, and this is the main mannerism period after the decay of the Renaissance. Now, this is a little difficult because this Renaissance movement actually did not take place in art all over Europe equally. For instance, Germany never had a Renaissance movement. They had something else instead, which they called the Reformation. Some people wonder why they actually should have built nice palaces instead. So this is a little different. It also differs from Germany, in Germany and in England. However, if we stick to literature, people have found out, if you start with the definition that we had last time, the way I repeated, this distortion, this search for hidden meaning by putting together things that actually should not be put together. Also this impossibility of making firm decisions. Where do you find that? In the most classical of all classic, almost English poets, you find it in Shakespeare. See, first you think it's impossible, you know, a nice four, five act plays, everything structured, everything smooth, nice solutions. But look at a character like Hamlet, for instance. Now, if you want a marvelous example for mannerism, here you have the Mona Lisa. He cannot make up his mind because he doesn't know what decision he should reach. Now, should he not? And secondly, which is even more characteristic, who cares whether he made up his mind this way, to kill or not to kill, to revenge or not? What difference does it make? Right? And so he hangs in between and doesn't know. This is maybe the most mannerist figure that Shakespeare ever created, or that many artists ever created, this Hamlet, you know, who cannot harmonize his ideas, who cannot center his thoughts, and therefore he cannot act. He doesn't know in which direction he can go. But he cannot put his forces together, so to speak, if that's what happens. He doesn't know whether to live or whether to die. Think of the scene with the skull in his hand at the end, the Yorick. The jester and the dead man. You have these contrasts all over the play, actually. Think of another good example in Shakespeare, Richard III. Maybe you remember this one scene. He has just killed the husband of one lady, and the casket is still there. What does he do? The lady cries, you know, blood and sweat and tears and everything, and he starts courting her almost next to the coffin in which the husband is, you know, whom he has just killed. But if you want anything more, let's say, two things that really do not fit together, you know, a murderer, you know, starts courting right away. almost next to the coffin in which his victim lies. These things do not fit together. However, you get this effect, you get something new, something great. People have just written article after article about this. But this, from this point of view again, that there is mannerism in literature and art, of course, you do find this in Shakespeare. Especially the late Shakespeare is a very, very good example for mannerism. And people from this point of view have compared him with Michelangelo, who also started as a classicist, one who was centering, ordering, and then the later period just distorted or left the marble crude, unfinished, or whatever it was. I mean, what do you do with Tempestburg? You read it, and then you really don't know what to do. I mean, no matter what the English professor says. There is one English professor here. So I wanted to make sure first. Now, this is an eternal riddle, because you cannot give a definite answer. Say this is the sentence, and Act 5 is opposed to Act 3 for the following reason, and so on. It's just our normal criteria do not work when applied to, let's say, Cymbeline or Tempest. It is something new, it's something entirely different. So usually we don't read it, right? We neglect it. We read Othello, Macbeth, King Lear, and so on. That works, you know. Here our criteria work. We can interpret, we can classify and analyze. But with the late ones, you know, we are not so sure. Okay, a marvelous example in England, actually development in England started with this late Shakespeare of the early 17th century, and then it moved, of course, to a group of poets which are called the Metaphysicals. Now, maybe the best example there is John Donne, although it depends whether you want to count it. Some people do, others don't. You know, they say, here's Donne, and then there's a group of followers who are called the Metaphysicals, but Donne is much greater. Are you familiar with John Donne from high school, or so? Is that still being read here? I never entered an American high school, so I don't know. Have you ever read some?
Yeah.
Okay. I found one anthology here in the Holden Library. Let's say one example first from Shakespeare. He is talking about a girl that did not quite do what he wanted her to do. Mm-hmm. And so it just, in other words, she didn't love him. Well, the speaker says this, and listen how he expresses this. He says, come away, death, and in sad Cyprus let me be laid. Fly away, breath. I am slain by a fair, cruel maid. My shroud of white stuck all with you, oh, prepare it. My part of death, no one so true did share it. And so on. Then there's another stanza where it just has one image after the other about death and funeral. Well, the only reason is he loves that girl, and the girl couldn't hear this. Actually, it's a love thing, you know, and he expresses this by means of death. This is an example how it just doesn't fit together. What else did I find here? Something by Donne. Yeah, this one is called The Funeral. It's just accidental that I take death, but maybe not. Whoever comes to shroud me, do not harm, nor question much that subtle wreath of hair about mine arm. You got this? It's very strange, very manneristic. Whoever comes to shroud me, do not harm, nor question much that subtle wreath of hair about mine arm. The mystery, the sign you must not touch, for 'tis my outward soul, viceroy to that which, unto heaven being gone, will leave this to control and keep these limbs, her provinces, from dissolution. I don't know whether you get it when I read that passage. But again, this hair, and then it continues how this piece of hair, this wreath of hair, moves upward, you know, defying all gravity, and moves upward to heaven. That's a fantastic distortion. Let's leave it at that, otherwise we'll have too many examples and you'll never get a chance to discuss. In Germany, the situation, of course, was similar. However, this horrible effect that we mentioned, what they called with Michelangelo, this terribilità, took place quite visibly there in the 17th century in form of the 30 Years' War. And you have a similar thing as we had in this poem yesterday, you know, about this concentration camp, that this horror and the grief about this war that went on and on and on could not be expressed in a nice, beautiful, smooth sonnet for him. But you have the same things, you have an abundance of metaphors and an abundance of embellishment. The poets go around and around and around and around and say it again and again and again and again, and no word actually seems to fit, seems to be enough for this kind of misery that we're confronted with. But they never say actually that's what it is. No, you have this abundance of metaphors, more and more embellishment, and the inside is left empty because there is no answer. You cannot say actually what this war is or what the effect on people is. It's just this going around and around and more and more and more with most fantastic images. Well, there are certain rhetorical and literary tricks on how to achieve this, but let's leave that out. You know, the hyperbolic style and so on. This, as you might have noticed, in the 17th century, probably you associate immediately Baroque with it. Right? You probably have heard of the term Baroque. Now, what does it mean again? People think it comes from pearl fishing, and a pearl which was caught and was not completely round, but was a little bit egg-shaped or crooked or whatever it was called barocco, meaning slanted, not round, that was to be thrown away, could not be sold. Right. And this first was applied as a nickname to this period. Again, it was not rounded, it was not centered, it did not make any sense, there were no answers, no messages, as we say nowadays, and therefore it was called Baroque, you know, Barocco, it didn't amount to much. Throw this kind of poem away, or think of sometimes these frightful Italian pictures, you know, in Caravaggio or something, you know, when you have nothing but gestures, you know, and absolutely nothing. It is a theater without a play, so to speak. You know, the theater runs away with whatever it is. It is gorgeous because it's so horrible, you know, I mean, but this style, you know. But again, from the study of mannerism, the Baroque period would be a manneristic period, and many people already try to do away with this rather vague term Baroque and just say, okay, this again is a mannerist movement. Let's move on past. Number four under this study then would be after the German classical movement in the 18th century, you know, where again a counter movement took place, which is called the Romantic movement. This is slightly different from what you are accustomed of calling Romantic. So here, romantic means primarily an abundance of feeling, isn't it? Softness, maybe love, and so on. Primarily an abundance of feeling. In German, it meant, and we have a lot of theory also with it, it is not any good old kind of feeling. It is especially a feeling of death, a feeling of, let's say, a love of night, of dream, of everything that is opposed to sunshine and day. You find truth only in the night, in your dream, in death, in everything that is not visible. Furthermore, for literature, this means that any kind of form, you know, where you study something and then try to structure it, is bad. Whatever you write down is necessarily bad. So the highest form of literature for these romantic poets was the fragment, believe it or not. But you, for instance, you cannot say what God is in a sonnet. Right? There's always something left out. Right? It is impossible to do that. So all you can do, you can have a fragment which points to the wholeness of whatever that is you cannot say, whether this is God or love or let's say the cosmos or anything, soul, death, life, you know, you can never express this fully. Therefore, they thought, okay, let's do away with all literary forms. Let's smash them all. And the only one that is worthwhile creating would be a fragment. And another possibility is to be equally vague. Again, you see this matter of position. To be equally vague, and they thought, when you can be really vague, that is only possible in one literary form, and that is the novel. Now, in the novel, you can just pour in whatever you have. You can intersperse it with poetry. You can also have little dialogues in it. So you get the drama in there, you get the lyricism in it by poems, and so on. Again, it is a vague form. It can begin vaguely somewhere. It doesn't necessarily have to end. You know, good novels are usually fragments, and so on. So what they thought was the most structured one was the novel and the fragment, because man cannot structure anymore. In this constant search for something, and this may be important again, they searched and searched and searched and were convinced that you could never find it. but still you have to search. This is maybe the key romantic idea. You spend your life constantly searching for God, for your own self, for meaning, whatever you might call it nowadays. But the moment you think you have found it, you're wrong. So this search must continue and continue and continue and continue. The moment you can say God is, forget it, you have heard, go on, you're wrong. So, therefore, this is reflected in literature, of course. You cannot structure, you cannot say God is, or life is, or she is, even, or he is, if it's a woman, or a lot of women. Of course, you can only have short little glimpses, or in forms of distortions. You can't pretend to know a little bit, but you will never know. And you spend your life in search and search and search. Okay, so much for this. Number four, the fourth manneristic movement. You find, of course, in a more let's say, watered down way, you find this in all romantic movements in Europe and also in the United States. Who would be a great mannerist of that period in the United States? What do you think? One that's been hailed as the greatest. Now, I don't know what you think of. One who is gloomy, who can give answers, who plays with death.
Oh.
Definitely, yes. Poe. He is in all over Europe, you know, he is maybe the greatest American author, believe it or not. And here he is somebody who writes funny stories, right? What does he call it? Something about the grotesque and arabesque, right? That's the full title. But he is maybe the greatest for this very reason. You know, he influenced European writing tremendously of this romantic period. But here you have it, this life and death thing, you know, not being able to give answers. At least he is not one who wrote suspense stories for a little boy. And Bill. Okay, now there was only actually, and now we are early 19th century, and there's only one more period to go, people think, and this is something I think we could discuss now in the remainder of our period. Do you think that the art forms that are created right now are also manneristic forms? See, many critics do so, others think no, it is not true. But from this historical study, many, many people thought, okay, this is what happens. In the 19th century, again, there was kind of a classical movement, let's say, as we might call it, a harmonized, structured, centered movement. And then at the end of last century, 1890, maybe prior to the First World War, again it clashed, the pendulum swung in the other direction, and we have mannerism right now, and we have not yet found a way out of it. This is something we could debate or discuss. Where would you find it, you mean? In let's say, take our literature. I read this one example, which of course was leading, of what did we have? Dylan Thomas. But only as a form poem, you know, a figure poem, because that's the only one I found here in the library. Any difference? But do you think, from whichever example you might think of, whether this is in painting now or literature, do you think you might find dominating examples that would justify to call this period of art in which we live right now, this era, also a manneristic period? The said opinion is divided, but maybe we can find something. Any kind of modern poetry, modern, not 19th, late 19th century, but 1971 if you want. I have to move away from that fire a little bit. I'm roasting. What do you mean? Yeah, by horror stories. You mean
horror,
Dracula or that stuff?
Horror stories, and they're right for teenagers that they just love. Their pictures and they so is that mannerism?
Yeah, I think you were quite right in saying I don't know whether this is literature.
Well, that's what I'm not even sure we should consider.
Or whether it's just sheer money making.
Yeah, that's what
but however, the point is, and I think this is actually something I want to get in on Saturday, the last in this week's series. The thinking behind it in our time, maybe that or the times before also, it is not only that art forms were created, but it branches off into all sorts of fields, theology, philosophy, and so on. this is something I think we should do on Saturday morning. So maybe the readiness of youngsters to read that stuff would be the answer. Now why would they read these horror stories? I mean, I have read one or two and that's it, you know. They're all the same anyhow. Isn't it? But why would you read something like this? You know quite well it is not true, realistically. You know, it is a distorted world. This would make it matter.
The devil makes me do it,
So it is a kind of distortion, but still it is very interesting that it's very gripping, you know, it's very suspenseful. I don't know.
It's not really putting together unexpected things because, like you say, when you've read a couple, you've kind of read them all because it does follow a different pattern. And you can always expect what's going to happen because it's the word. So it isn't two different unexpected things put together. Mm-hmm. It's kind of all the same.
In this respect, yeah, this is maybe why I said I'm not sure whether this is literature. Whether this is really based on a feeling of horror that you cannot express by any other way. This putting together of two different things is one method only. You can also have, let's say, think maybe of these elaborate gestures in Italian paintings of that period, where you have nothing but gestures and nothing else. It may also be the emphasis on the outside and the neglect of an inside, because there cannot be an inside that you can express. So there are many, many possibilities, and this is why it's worthwhile discussing. I can't give you a definite answer, but we can just chat about it a little bit. Don't think you have to come up with a profound knowledge of modern art. Just whatever crosses your mind when you think of it. When you think modern art, what crosses your mind? Think
that.
Pardon? Yeah. Again, we that's kind of difficult. Yeah, it depends. Let's say, think of a statue of 800, maybe you've seen one in Germany, right? A crucifixus. Is that abstract or not? Definitely it is. It's very unrealistic. It is almost woody. It's just one piece of wood. No anatomical study. No, it's just a figure hanging there, very crude. This is also kind of abstraction. They wanted to show that Jesus was not only a man, therefore no anatomy, but the Son of God, and therefore they abstracted from reality. Right? So this, I mean, with that term alone, I don't think we can do that much. So just say a little more, maybe we can get there. Is there anything you had in mind, Barbara? When we say abstract art, yes.
Well, I was thinking of the pictures, that you really have to look at, and I don't really, one can't really do anything when I look at them.
Yeah, well, I think this is quite good that you mentioned this. You know, I think as in the difficulty that we have, not only with the logs, but with understanding modern poetry and modern art, is that that we do not first look, or that we do not bear in mind that there are two possibilities of looking at them. I think it is absolutely essential to find out, is this work at which we are looking, is that harmonized, centered, is it what people have called the classical one, or is it the opposite? What you do maybe is you come with your, in quotation mark, classical mind, and look at a non-classical work. Right? And then it doesn't fit. You look at it and say, well, what is it? Ridiculous. It was hanging upside down anyhow, and won first prize, and everything you mentioned last time. Nobody knew it was hanging upside down. And that's ridiculous. But this is something, but as an aside only.
Yesterday we were using a soup can, Andy Warhol. Soup can is an example, and that I think people would be familiar with. What do you do with that? What kind of that manner is it?
You mean a soup can as what?
The painted soup can. Have you seen that? In
picture.
Oh yeah.
Exactly representation. Uh-huh. Pain in art. Mm-hmm. An art form. What's that? Or a poem that's just a pomegranate, melon, raspberry. That's what it says.
Okay, exactly this soup thing secondary, but this, if you just have a few words, as you said, is that a poem?
Well, it what I mean by art and poem, or painting and poem here, as far as considering it as art forms, is you find them where you expect to find a poem, like in a poetry painting, or you find the soup can in the museum. So you're looking at it, you're sort of told it's in the frame of art, right? This is literature and it's modern.
One difficulty is, of course, who decides what gets into a museum. You know?
Sure.
There are certain people, you know, primarily in New York, you know, who decide. And it's usually not the quality of the work of art, whether classical or mannerist, but the hosts and the prophets called the dollar, right?
Yeah.
Which decide. But still, when you have, I have to move also, right? My goodness. when you have a poem like this, which is just, as you said, a sequence of nouns that somehow belong together, I would say, yes, this is a manneristic attempt. But by finding, as in our definition, by finding a relationship between those two things, you cannot really say what it is logically, otherwise you would at least have come up with a sentence and say, I like raspberries just as well as pomegranates or whatever it is. You know? Or pomegranates are a shame because there's nothing to them but seeds, or, right? So something like this. If you cannot do this, you just confront it and let them more or less react. And this would be similar maybe to what you called an abstract poem. What we try to find out, find something in the an abstract painting. You try to see something in it, whereas maybe the painter only wanted a reaction of colors and shapes and forms, nothing else, which cannot then be more verbalized. But this definitely would fit in. Maybe you all know Gertrude Stein, you know, where she couldn't say anymore, but a rose is a rose is a rose, you know, which is intellectual bankruptcy, of course. You can't say it. Yes, this definitely would fit in.
I don't know if I know what you mean by mannerism.
Nobody knows. As I said, yeah. Just what I.
No, what are you? How are you using it? It's when I think of it, I think of the prevailing style of a whole period, and with many, say, poets writing in the same style, to where you couldn't really tell. Who wrote the poem, unless, the names, there are different names at the bottom of each poem, but they all are written in the same style. Is that what you mean by mannerism?
No, necessarily. No, I mean this uncentered, not structured, not harmonized kind of poem, the distorted one. I do not mean this negatively. But as it was done before, people just thought this was trash and dumped it. You know?
Yeah.
But it is a different way, again, usually arising from horror that cannot be expressed in another way. So that you do not coordinate, that you have this an abundance of metaphors. Mm-hmm. That was saying the same thing again and again and again and again. Or that you have, let's say, the sound run away with the meaning. There is no meaning, actually. Mm-hmm. Or that you have, let's say, compare two things that cannot be compared. Just whatever is distorted, whenever you cannot sum it up, maybe, or center it, as I called it, then it is called mannerism. Maybe this one poem that you are all familiar with, because it has been read so many times in whole, Gerard Manley Hopkins, familiar with him? He wrote one poem that has frequently been used here for Vespers. I think, which is called The Wind Hover, subtitled To Christ Our Lord. The wind hover is just a wild bird of prey or something like this, a wild bird. You will not understand what I'm reading right now, not everything. But he intentionally has the sound and the rhythm and the images run away with understanding. You will not be able to understand the meaning of the images. It is primarily sound. Let me just read maybe the old thing. I caught this morning morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dauphin, dappled dawn-drawn falcon in his riding, of the rolling level underneath him steady ear. And striding high there, how he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy. Then off, off forth on swing, as a skate's heel sweeps smooth on a bow bend, they hurl and gliding rebuff the big wind. My heart in hiding stirred for a bird, the achieve of the mastery of a thing. Brute, beauty, and valor, and act, oh, air, pride, plume, here, buckle, and the fire that breaks from thee then a billion times told, lovelier, more dangerous, oh, my chevalier. No wonder of it, sheer plot makes plow down zillion, shine, and blue bleak embers, ah, my dear, fall, gall themselves, and gash gold vermilion. It's one of the most outstanding modern poems, I think, although written in the 19th century already. But you see, what does he say? Sum it up.
You think if two different individuals would interpret that, if they would get the same interpretation, or would they get different interpretations?
It depends on how you interpret it. I mean, what you want. If you sum it up, I think you are wrong. You will never achieve anything. But what you find is again a texture of all sorts of rhythmical and melodic elements that come together, and they express ecstasy, joy, maybe. I think it's a marvelous poem, don't get me wrong. It's a great poem. But when we come up with the same techniques as, let's say, I wandered lonely as a cloud, you know, Wordsworth, and try to use these criteria for this one, we have to call it bad. And same thing when we use this moving, wild style of Hopkins and to interpret Wordsworth. You know, Wordsworth is bad. You know, he has no enthusiasm. He's cold like a fish. So I think we always must try to find what is it, the centered one, or is it one that is not centered. Now here there is one central image, the wind hover, you know. Hey, what is that? Check in the encyclopedia, there is no such thing under W as a wind hover. It doesn't exist. And many of these words you probably, although English is your native language, will have to check. You know, because you have never heard them. They are from what, the 15th century? Or then this is also reflected in the print here. Sometimes this conjunction and, for instance, is capitalized in bold-faced print. And that's a word that should not be capitalized. You know, this is the least important word. But he wants the sound bang on this word. So that, again, the enthusiasm runs away with the meaning of the sentence. And the sentences are not complete either in here. Well, you have fragment beside fragment. It's a marvelous thing to express enthusiasm, I think. But again, from a Wordsworth point of view, awful.
You mentioned this where Tell murdered the husband of the wife husband. They love Lady Porter. Such a contrast there between hate and love. And maybe it seems like in life, you know, there is a real thin line between hate and love, and it's possibly just Shakespeare the way over dramatically trying to say that maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe in other artists they have these different feelings in life, and they're just trying to express these real, I don't think over dramatic is the word, but they're blowing them up so much that they seem out of proportion. It's ridiculous, but I think life is full of cool contrast. And they blow them up.
Yeah, it depends. You know, of course, we say it is full of contrast, or you say, or let's say paradoxes or antinomies, whatever you want to call it. The question is, what do you do with them? Do you solve them and say, well, hate and, let's say, love is better than hate, right? Then you make a decision. You put hate beneath love. But when you say, what is it? There's only a very thin line, as you said, between them. So hate is almost the same as love. Why should I love? Let me hate. Right? What shall I do anyhow? The result is Hamlet's figure who can't make up his mind. But then the poetic expression is only the result of it. I think this is what you find. And then why order it? You know, just to please the critics in Madison Avenue? It's ridiculous. But leave it. I know quite well you find in a poem, you know, that there is such a thin line. Now, what is the line between the bird and Jesus, you know, from that point of view? To ask me, say, it's ridiculous, you know. My goodness. You know, all of Concordia Seminary, they probably say, ooh. But it depends on whether, A, you can do it, I think, as an artist, and B, whether you want to do it. Whether you do not think that this acceptance of the thin line is more honest than solving something.
For me, there's trying to express it, not that it's all
that. Right, right, right.
Their way is
it. And so you just, let's say, let the colors or the shapes in an abstract painting react. It doesn't mean anything, they just react. You know, brown reacts with white there, and you get a certain tension, but there is no answer to it. No solution.
Some of the late songs that have been written, I can't just say the examples, but I think they try to come to some solution.
Read that sonnet, and it's quite standard.
Yeah.
Sonnet,
yes,
still the same style, so more understandable.
Yes, I just wanted to give this example as.
Yeah, yeah, as but the same person, you know, same poet, more, it's more understandable.
Right.
It's written in the sonnet form, right. Quite tight. You know.
That is similar to Shakespeare. Shakespeare also wrote very classical stuff. You know,
yeah.
Not only this. I just gave you this as a modern example of a well-known poet, especially as some people call him a Christian poet, although I don't like this definition. But you have this, you know, this wildness. I think it's this wildness, this enthusiasm that made him great,
mm-hmm.
Not the traditional, well-structured sonnet. But somebody was trying to say something, we were interrupting him or her. He was it. Okay. Have you maybe heard of this movement called Expressionism prior to First World War? In both literature and art and all over. This is a marvelous example. It fits the definition of mannerism to the last item. Now again, the expression is much more, the personal, individual expression is much more important than actually a kind of message, content, program, whatever it is. It's just out with it. Get out this tremendous feeling of awe, of love, of terror, or whatever it is, of vastness. Get it out.
What is that there about?
He is the arch mannerist.
There
is no greater mannerist than Salvador Dali in the world, you know, including his own lifestyle.
Yeah, everything about him is super realistic, out of proportion. You know, take one detail and blow it up so perfectly. Mm-hmm. It's just to every pore, practically.
Well, he has changed, he has done fantastic things. Right now he's making money, you know, by traveling the cities in the United States and painting a series of, I don't know what, Chicago, San Francisco. He has done something in San Francisco also, hmm? And selling it for $1,000, you know, something. And this is very naturalistic, I mean, nothing Jewish. But he has one, since you mentioned, he has one I think it's a sepia etching or whatever it is, of Caesar. From Shakespeare's Caesar, you know, you have a nice head of the Roman emperor, you know, with the laurel wreath and everything, and then there is a huge ant, you know, on one of his ears. That's very naturalistically, you know, just like the ones here in Koinonia, you know, this big wood ant, you know, that thing that's sitting there. Now, if you want the clash, yeah, here it is, you know. If you look at answers that cannot be given, there it is. What does Caesar have to do with that ant? Still, you see, well...
Does he have a big message he's trying to say? I don't
know.
He's got nothing. He's just showing absurdity.
Yeah, but wouldn't that be an answer?
Yeah. But I mean...
This is exactly what we call absurd. That is a form of mannerism, because you cannot structure it. You cannot give an answer. Well, this is absurd, yes.
That's his whole message.
No, that is his non-message,
yeah.
Obviously, right? To be exact. Right. There is no message within mannerist art, no mannerist thinker. And the strange thing is Dali sells like hotcakes nowadays, you know, isn't it? People pay anything for Dali. But he would be a prime example, you know, the way he dresses himself, also the way he walks, and the way he refuses to speak English, you know, and all that. Yeah, would you have other examples that might shed some light on it? Whether we can call this period. I mean, you probably have noticed that I definitely do think that we again live in a manneristic period right now. And as far as thinking, philosophy, theology is concerned, we'll just try to sum this up a little bit more on Saturday. But as far as art is concerned for today, definitely so. There probably has never been a more manneristic period than ours. So, which is great for our understanding of it, I think. You see, I think it helps a lot when you see that there's a long tradition that started 500 BC, maybe, you know, and the pendulum has constantly swung back and forth and back and forth. And right now we have one, again, of disharmony, of distortion in art. Therefore, let's look at the words with these criteria. Don't let's take the other one. Then we always say, it's nothing, I don't understand, it doesn't turn me on. And so on. And I think this might be a help for our approach of modern art if we do not look for a message or something that can be centered, that can be put together, harmonized, answered. You know, there is no answer with either and an answer here.
When you're saying centered, do you mean critical?
Centered, you know, centered.
Centered. Oh, that's it. I kept misunderstanding that sentence.
What about these things like the backdrop for our worship service, you know, the banners or the sheet, some of them, you know, just have some symbolic things, and they have a message, I guess. And others have a lot of words, you know, and they're kind of more explicit to say what they want to say. Now, is this a form of modern art? Mm-hmm. They're all over the place.
This is hard to decide since we do not have examples here. If you say that when they illustrate something from the Bible or from the service or whatever, it is definitely that is the message, and it is a good one also, right? It's called gospel, and therefore it cannot be manneristic. I would say this may be kind of a heretical opinion, but there you have a definite, precise answer. However, in the form of Jesus, you know, there I think it depends on how much emphasis you put on Jesus, on Christ. When you start out with the incomprehensibility of God, then mannerism enters. But this is what you have in Don's vision, metaphysical, but also in this time.
So, if it has any type of a message at all, then
I wouldn't say so. On the other hand, I don't want to confuse, but I would say that there isn't a message anywhere. You know, this is something that that high school teachers demand of us, and we can answer in form of true/false tests afterwards. You know, it comes in so handy with the I don't know, Macbeth means, you know, so and so checked in the right box. You know, it's very, isn't it?
I think that maybe people are hesitant to admit or express the fact that there is no meaning in something, that there's nothing there, and that someone who is trying simply to express the meaning of this is doing something.
Right. And this is what you have all the time, you know, in our modern literature, painting, sculpture, and everything.
Distinguish between meaning and
message
stuff? Yes. I mean, yes. That has meaning, but
message to me.
It's propaganda.
Yeah, right. This seems to be practical. No, get it, learn it by heart, and then live better, or something like that. Or you'll make more money, you know, whatever it is. That would be ridiculous. A meaning, yes, that's something else. It's not necessarily practical. But still, with critics, you find it. I don't know what this bell was for, it's 10 o'clock. Okay, then let's try to continue and get a little bit more, let's say, background to it, or let's check the thinking behind this. I mean, you indicated this already when you cannot give an answer. Now, we get this will approach philosophy, theology, and this next time. What kind of a man is this Hamlet figure, or this vaguely vague smile of Mona Lisa, or our grimaces, our Campbell soup cans. Let's try to sum this up next time. Maybe you can think a little bit till Saturday and come up with a few examples. It was a little fast today, but maybe you can think of some till Saturday. Okay, enjoy your coffee break.